So we finished the first section, which was from 1 to 12, was described, Krishna was describing or summarizing his teachings that he gave in the first six chapters about Karma Yoga. So that section, from 1 to 12, it represents the first six chapters, and it summarizes the philosophy in the first six chapters. So now this next section represents the last six chapters, and it summarizes the philosophy given in the last six chapters dealing with karma, Jnana Yoga. Well, we can say from 13 to 17. And here, Krishna has done this before, like in chapter 4, chapter 5 also. He got philosophical about Nishkam Karma Yoga and described action in inaction and action in action and things like this. So we see that actually jnana and karma are, they're very closely linked. So here he's like analyzing Nishkam Karma, and when one performs Nishkam Karma, he becomes purified, and then to that degree knowledge arises in his heart. So this is what is being described here. And here, this section, Krishna cites Vedanta, or he analyzes Vedanta. He describes that there's five kinds of causes to every action. So he's looking at karma from the point of jnana. So in the commentaries, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has Arjuna asking a question which links these sections. In the last section, Krishna said that someone who's not renounced, he accrues these threefold kinds of reaction. But a sannyasi who's renounced, he never gets such results. So then Arjuna says, how can one work and not get the fruit of that work? And Krishna's answer is that one must work without false ego in order to reap no fruit from work. By giving up the sense of doership and knowing that I am the supreme doer, then he gets no reaction. So that is the meaning of this section, of these verses from 13 to 18. There's two more lights over here where we can put on. Maybe they're in the back there or over here. Oh, and there's fans too. Oh, wonderful. You can turn this one off. I don't think it's not so hot. Okay. Okay, let's chant these verses. Panchayatani mahabaho karanani nibhurame sankye kritante proktani siddhaye sarva karmanam. Almighty armed Arjuna, according to the Vedanta, there are five causes for the accomplishment of all action. Now learn of these from me. So, to help us perform activities without becoming bound, Krishna speaks Vedanta and analyzes all activities into five causes. We see here Prabhupada asks this, almost the same question as in the commentaries of Vishwanath Chakravarti. A question may be raised that since any activity performed must have some reaction, how is it that the person in Krishna consciousness does not suffer or enjoy the reactions of work? The Lord is citing Vedanta philosophy to show how this is possible. He says that there are five causes for all activities, and for success in all activity, one should consider these five causes. The ultimate control is invested in the Supersoul, as stated in Bhagavad Gita, Sarvasichaham Redisanivishta. He is engaging everyone in certain activities by reminding him of his past actions. And Krishna-conscious acts done under his direction from within yield no reaction, either in this life or in the life after death. So Krishna is now describing what he was saying in verse 12, how to be a sannyasi and get no reaction. And this is the main verse of this section, number 14, an important verse. Adhishtanam tata karta karanam cha pritak vidham vivedascha pritak cheshta daivam chayvatrut panchamam. The place of action, the body, the performer, the various senses, the many different kinds of endeavor, and ultimately the Supersoul. These are the five factors of action. So, adhishtanam, that means the body. Right. The place of action. The entire body. And karta means the doer. So, the soul within the body, the conditioned soul is acting and working, and he's getting some activity. He's bringing about results of activity. So he's called the doer. In the material world, the soul is acting with a certain hat on, playing a role. So therefore he's acting through the false ego. Therefore, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakura says that Dakarta is the ahankara, or the false ego, whereas Baladeva Dibhushan says it's the atma. And Prabhupada always sides with Baladeva Dibhushan. So he presents it this way. But actually when the soul is in this world, he's acting through the false ego. So therefore it could be also said that it is the false ego which is acting. Because ultimately the soul doesn't do anything. So it seems that in order to keep the soul free from, kind of rather transcendental, Vishnath presents that it's the false ego. And he says, false ego, a knot that ties chit to jud. It's the knot that ties together the spirit to matter. Then karanam means also something like the body, but the senses of the body, the particular sense organs. So something different from the whole body, just the senses. And then pritak cheshta. Cheshta here means the endeavor, particularly the functions of the life airs, like prana and apana. Pritak, different kinds of endeavor. It always includes the pranas. And ultimately, there we have Daiva, that is the Supreme, the Supersoul within the heart. As Prabhupada mentioned, Sarvasya Haham, Chaham Ridisani Vishto, that I am situated in the heart, in the last commentary. He says in the commentary, but all one's activities depend on the will of the Supersoul, who is seated within the heart as a friend. The Supreme Lord is the super cause. And the last sentence, those in complete Krishna consciousness are not ultimately responsible for their actions. Everything is dependent on the Supreme Will, the Supersoul, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this idea will be echoed again when Krishna, in a later section, describes work. In text 23 to 25, And he describes the doer also in 26 to 28 in the different modes of nature. Kind of echoes some of this same theme. So this is an analysis of Sankhya or Vedanta, looking at the world, right? That in any work or in any action done by anyone, there's always these five causes. So this is absolute knowledge that can be applied to any circumstance. And it is often necessary to quote this verse when discussing philosophy. So you should, it's not on the test, but those who are preachers should know this verse. Throughout the Gita, when Krishna speaks about karma or karma yoga, he's trying to prompt Arjuna to perform his duty and fight. Right? He just finished talking about karma. So, but when Krishna speaks jnana also, he's also trying to prompt Arjuna to fight, in the sense to get Arjuna to understand that he's not the doer, and thus free Arjuna from responsibility, which he felt hanging on his shoulders and was making him worried and afraid, and it was kind of paralyzing him. Right. So Krishna is speaking jnana also to incite Arjuna to fight, to make it very clear that ultimately the ultimate cause behind any action is the Supersoul, and that it's not you, Arjuna. You're just one of the causes. You're the karta, but higher than you is the daiva. So you should surrender. And later in the chapter he says you should surrender to that Supersoul in the heart. Right? Surrender unto him utterly, he says. So both karma and jnana are being quoted or presented by Krishna to incite Arjuna to fight, but really to get him to perform bhakti. So once Krishna is using karma and jnana to bring Arjuna to bhakti. It's interesting. So now Baladeva Vibhushan has written that in this commentary to verse 14. If the jiva is under control of the Lord, then his acts don't come from his own will, and he's just like a stone. In that case, don't the injunctions of the Shastra become useless? Because the Shastra tells you to do something or to not do something. But if the living entity is being controlled and by the Lord, the ultimate doer, cause of action is the Lord, then what is the use of Shastra? Then the jiva atma is like a puppet being controlled by God. So then he answers this. It's interesting. He says, from the Lord, the jiva gets a body and senses with specific potencies, by which he then becomes the proprietor. Acquiring these potencies, the jiva exerts his free will and assumes control of his body and senses to fulfill karmic endeavors. The Lord, from within, sanctions that the jiva's acts and inspires him to act. Thus, there's no contradiction between the Lord's control and the jiva's own willpower to act or to refrain from acting. Because the Lord fulfills, facilitates, supports, and energizes the jiva's desires by the body, the senses, the intelligence, and sometimes even the environment for his action. So in this way, although the Lord is the super cause, it's not that the jiva loses his role in any action. He also has a very primary role to play, because the Lord is sensing his desire and then facilitating him by giving him all of these energies of the senses, intelligence, and so forth. Sometimes people minimize the jiva's role to the point of nil, right? Where he becomes like a puppet, and then the Lord is just the controller of everything. But then the Lord has the responsibility for everything that happens in the world. And he said before, "Na dati kasichit papam na chayva sukritam vibhu." Right? Only the jiva is ignorance which is causing him to do all these things. We analyze this in chapter 5, and that's called, remember what is the English word for that?
Etiology.
It's a science of causation. Right. So some very intelligent persons in India, they have this idea. At least they think they're very intelligent. And they can quote different shastric statements because there are many places where the role of the jiva is minimized, even in the Gita. But one has to know the full, rounded Siddhanta in order to get a full picture on what's happening. Because there may be different reasons, even psychological reasons, why a person may do that. He may feel guilty for something that he did, and therefore he may try to minimize the responsibility of the jiva philosophically to justify his own fault like this. There may be so many reasons why someone may do this. So it seems that this question and answer from Baladeva Vidyabhushan to this verse is significant to explain this. And especially if you're preaching here in India, you're going to meet a lot of these kind of persons. You know, feel that karma is superior, or that the jiva has no, minimizes the jiva's role completely in action. Okay, let's go to the next verse, which is connected. Sharira vanmano bhiryat karma prarabhate naraha nyayam va viparitam va panchayate tasahetava. Whatever right or wrong action a man performs by body, mind, or speech is caused by these five factors. So right and wrong is based upon the scriptures. If it's within the Shastra, it's right. And if it's outside of the parameters of Shastra, it's wrong. Prabhupada gives this very clear definition in his commentary. So you have another five factors, actually, in this verse. You have Sharira, Van, and Mana. Sharira, Vak, and Mana, the body, words, and mind. And you have Nyaya, and viparitam. Something is right or wrong and performed with the body, speech, or mind. And all of these things, again, can be seen times five in the last verse. So all work by the body, right, caused by these five factors, all work with speech, all work with the mind, and it all right and wrong work can all be divided by these, or seen in light of the previous five causes. So you have 25 divisions now. Just, you know, very easily, very quickly. Of course, there's many more kinds of endeavors, but this is fairly full analysis. When you get into Sankhya, you can keep going deeper and deeper and analyzing, dividing, categorizing. And in the 11th canto, Krishna does that. He's saying, this is a little confusing. Some rishis say that everything's divided into 24 elements. Some say 18, some say 16, some say 12, some say 3, 5, some say 48. He says, so what is it? What is really the truth? And Krishna says, they're all right. Because when you analyze the material world, you can give it in major categories or sub-major or sub-sub or minor or sub-minor, you know. And then as you go down, it's more and more and more. you know, divisions. So he says, actually, they're all correct. Text 16.
Tatraivam sati kartaram atmanam kevalam tuyaha pashantya kritya buddhitvan sa nasa pashyati durmitihi.
Therefore, one who thinks himself the only doer, not considering the five factors, is certainly not very intelligent and cannot see things as they are. So here's a nice verse which reminds one of 327, when Krishna said, Ahankara vimudatma kartaham iti manyate. So he has some similar words here, kartaram and mudurmati. And before he was saying this person who thinks he's the doer, right, that he's a vimudha. Now he says he's durmati, fool. Another word for fool. So the word kevalam here means only I have done it. I am the only cause for my actions. By the sweat of my brow, the strength of my arm, I will conquer and control. I will become successful in this world. Look out. Don't stand in my way. Right? It's kind of like Ishwar aham, aham bhogi, siddhaham balavan sukhi. It's kind of, it's a passionate, asuric kind of mentality. And this here, so he says, pasyati akritva buddhidva nasa pasyati durmati. Right? He sees, but he does not see. Similar to the Bhagavatam, pasyanapi na pasyati. He sees, but because he's akritva buddhitvat, it means a non-active intelligence, sleeping intelligence. Right? Which means basically he's foolish. His buddhi is not active, so he cannot see. Here in the commentary, Prabhupada says, a foolish person cannot understand that the Supersoul is sitting as a friend within and conducting his actions. Although the material causes are the place, worker, endeavor, the senses, and the final cause is the Supreme, the personality of Godhead. Therefore, one should see not only the four material causes, but the supreme efficient cause as well. One who does not see the supreme thinks himself to be the only doer. Kevalam. That's how he uses this word. Vishnu Chakravarti says, he doesn't see properly because he lacks purified intelligence. Akritta buddhidvat. Therefore, he cannot see properly. Seeing is dependent on your buddhi, your intelligence, what you see. How you think is what you see, and what you see is what you get. I think it was Baladev Vidyabhushan says, the cause of bondage is the feeling that only he himself is the doer. So then one might ask, well, who has purified intelligence and actually sees? Then Krishna answers in the next verse.
Yasya na hankrito bhavo buddhir yasya na lipyate hadvapi saimalukan na hante na nibhadyate.
One who is not motivated by false ego, whose intelligence is not entangled, though he kills men in this world, does not kill, nor is he bound by his actions. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says, he doesn't become attached to thinking, this is pleasing or this is not pleasing. And I believe it was Baladev Vidyabhushan who commented that such a person is not bound, even if he kills the entire universe, what to speak of Bhishma and Drona and Kripa, who are your fear. So Prabhupada says, in this verse, the Lord informs Arjuna that the desire not to fight arises from false ego. Arjuna thought himself to be the doer of action, but he did not consider the supreme sanction within and without. If one does not know that a super sanction is there, why should he act? But one who knows the instruments of work, himself is the worker, and the Supreme Lord is the Supreme Sanctioner, is perfect in doing everything. Such a person is never an illusion. Personal activity and responsibility arise from false ego and godlessness, or lack of Krishna consciousness. Interesting here. So responsibility arises from godlessness. Sometimes we need to remind our devotees to be responsible, right? Because sometimes they're so philosophically renounced that they become irresponsible, and then they let Krishna's vehicles go to hell or something else go to hell, you know, because they're not responsible. Because, you know, Krishna, he'll take care of it. It's his car. Something like that. So, I mean, you can take it too far if you go too far one way. But the devotees taking responsibility is something different than what's being described here. We'll just finish the commentary. Anyone who is acting in Krishna consciousness under the direction of the Super Soul or the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even though killing, does not kill. Nor is he ever affected by the reaction of such killing. When a soldier kills under the command of a superior officer, he is not subject to be judged. But if a soldier kills on his own personal account, then he is certainly judged by a court of law. So if we're acting under authority, then we do that as responsibly as we can. But we know that ultimately we cannot, you know, control the results of that activity. So we just do the best we can, and we're acting responsibly to please Krishna and Guru. But not that we ourselves can control the outcome of the event, ultimately. So here Krishna is describing the person who is nahankrita bhava. So he's not situated in false ego. Therefore, his intelligence is not entangled. And he can actually see things as they are. He understands that there's these five causes. So acting acting in accord with the will of the Supreme, therefore he doesn't gain or accrue any reactions for his work, even though he's acting in the world. And even in the material world, we see that if somebody doesn't have a sense of doership, then he's not held accountable for his actions. Just like a child has no sense of doership. A child may spit on you or kick you or something, but they don't, you know, the police don't come and grab the child and arrest him or her, right? Because it's a child. Or an animal, like a dog. The dog may, you know, pass stool in the wrong place, but he's not arrested. There's no signs that say, please, dogs, do not pass stool in this place. Because they realize that the dog, he doesn't have a sense of doership. Or even a human being, an adult who's mad, who's crazy, if he does something wrong, even if he kills somebody, then they don't put him in jail like an ordinary criminal. If he's proven, you know, to be, you know, psychologically impaired. Psychotherapist or psychiatrist, they prove that in the court of law, then he's, you know, there may be some restrictions on him, they may watch him or something, but they don't put him in jail. He's not held accountable. So similarly, here Krishna is saying that a person on the spiritual, this in the material world, so in the spiritual world, if someone doesn't have the sense of doership, he doesn't think that I am the, you know, the initiator of this action, and I am the sole proprietor and doer of this action, then he's not accountable for that action. And Prabhupada gives the example of a soldier. During the war, the soldier goes and kills so many people on the order of the general or his authority. And he's given medals. But if he comes home and then he goes to some, you know, club or bar or something and he just starts shooting people, then he's arrested and he may be killed for that. So it's a completely different circumstance. So Krishna is saying also spiritually, someone who's actually acting under the will of the Supreme as a kind of karma yoga soldier, it means he's working in the world, but he's just doing it out of duty to purify himself, to set a good example for others, and to ultimately to please the Supreme. He's a Bhagavad Arpita Nishkam Karma Yogi soldier. Then that person doesn't get any reactions to his work and his actions in the world. And that answers Arjuna's question. And Krishna's saying that, you know, a person can kill the whole world and not get a reaction. What to speak of killing these three men, these heroes, Bhishma, Drona, and Karna, or Kripa, the one you're worried so much about them. But you won't incur any sin. Okay, now the last verse of the section. Just to make it a little bit more philosophical, Krishna goes deeper. Jnanam geyam parigyata trivida karma chodana karanam karma karteti trivida karma sangraha. Knowledge, the object of knowledge, and the knower are the three factors that motivate action. The senses, the work, and the doer are the three constituents of action. So here are some familiar terms, right? From chapter 13, Jnanam, Gyanam, Parigyata, that's the new one, right? So we have two lines. We have two things here called, one is Karma Chodana and Karma Sangraha. And they each have three divisions. First, let's try to understand what does it mean, this karma chodana. We know what karma means. Now, chodana, according to Monier Williams' dictionary, means impelling, invitation, direction, rule, or precept. And generally, it seems that the idea of impelling, or impetus, or motivation, is the way that the word is being used. And Prabhupada translates it as such, and others also. The impetus, Prabhupada writes. Others say chodana means encouragement or like a command from Shastra. Gopal Bhatta Goswami says that chodana, upadesh, and vidhi or synonyms. Gopal Bhatta Goswami. Chodana, upadesha, and vidhi are all the same. The same meaning. They're synonymous. So in other words, like an instruction or rule from the Shastra. It can also... So Prabhupada says that whether the impetus comes from the Shastra or the Guru, it's the same in the commentary. Right? So he covers both of these ideas. He translates chodana as impetus, but in the commentary he describes that there may be some impetus coming from Guru and Shastra, which will corresponds with the other definitions of this word. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that here chodana means injunction or process. So there's quite a lot of, you know, analysis of this word, as you can see, by different persons. In any case, karma chodana is divided into these three, jnana, geyam, and parigyata. So jnana, you know, means knowledge. So knowledge of what? of the soul and the super soul. And that is the next thing, the geyam, the object of the knowledge, is the soul and super soul. And the knower is also the soul and the super soul. And there's three functions. Ultimately, they're the same. So you could look at it that the knower, the parigyata, is the atma, right? And he's getting scriptural knowledge about the paramatma, which is the ultimate object of knowledge, the geyam, like this. This is one, you know, scenario or one translation, one view. And I would say that would be like the general view. Are you confused enough yet? Or shall we go further? There's, now we have, we want to read, I'm going to read Vishnu, then Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and then we'll read Prabhupada's commentary. That'll get you from all sides. Hopefully you'll understand what's being said now. Okay. So Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur comments that, according to the Lord's opinion, sannyas, now actually he gives a very long commentary here. I just took a few lines out of this because it was too long to describe. He's quoting many verses from the Bhagavatam, and he gets into a whole thing of comparing bhakti to jnana and nishkam karma. I'll explain a little bit. According to the Lord's opinion, sannyas in the form of tyaga in sattva-gun is instructed for the jnanis. This is what he's saying the topic is here. According to the Lord's opinion, sannyas in the form of renunciation in sattva-gun is instructed for the jnanis here. But for the bhaktas, complete renunciation of karma-yoga is recommended. Okay, now back to the jnanis. Jnana requires purification of the heart. Nishkam karma enables one to achieve different levels of such purification, and jnana rises in proportion to the degree the heart is purified. There is no other way for the jnana to appear in the heart. The only way for knowledge is to appear is that the heart has to be pure. Therefore, it is necessary for even the sannyasis to practice nishkam karma yoga for complete knowledge to appear in their hearts. When nishkam karma has completely purified the heart, karma is no longer required. Then he quotes Bhagavad Gita 3:17, atma triptas materiasya, something like this, right? That's when Krishna was describing that for the self-realized person, there's no duty to perform. So this is another place where he describes, I remember Chaitanya Charanprabhu was saying that, you know, the Gita really slams Jnana Yoga, right? But here, 3:17, Krishna says, for the Atma Tripta, he has no karma, no duty to do, because he's Atma Tripta. So there is a level like that, and Krishna mentions it right in the early third chapter. And then also he quotes 6:3, which we mentioned before, this Aruruksha Munair Yoga. And he says, yoga rudasya karma shama uchite. When one is on the higher level, yoga ruda, then it is said for him to give up. So he quotes these two places there when he's describing. So Krishna does there. The place where the person gets purified performing his karma yoga, and then he should give up that karma yoga. But that's the second stage of renunciation. First stage is the person gives up all attachment to the fruits of the work. Then later he gives up the work and everything. And then later he has to give up the knowledge that he acquires from the work. That's the third level of renunciation. Because he can't become gunatit unless he gives up his sattva gun gyan, right? Which makes him realize I'm not the body. So if he has to transcend that even, the third level of renunciation. Okay, now, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, It's very simple. Any action has two states, inspiration and basis. Chodana and Sangraha. This is his translation. Inspiration and basis. Yeah, any action has two states. Two levels, right? Two states. First one is inspiration, and the second one is the basis, or he's called Sangraha. The word Sangraha also means like combination or accumulation. Like Sangha, like, right? Like you have a Sangha, right? Society or something, right? Combination, accumulation. Okay, now Bhaktivinoda continues. He says, the process which precedes work is called chodana. In other words, chodana, or inspiration, always comes before the action. Okay? Inspiration, or chodana, is the subtle existence of action and is to be understood to be the faith which exists in the mind before the gross action manifests. The faith in the mind before you do the work. That's what he's describing chodana means. Okay, now we will read Srila Prabhupada's commentary. There are three kinds of impetus for daily work: the knowledge, the object of knowledge, and the knower. The instruments of work, the work itself and the worker, are called the constituents of work. He uses this word, which is sangraha, constituents, which is good. It's a good translation. Very exact. Any work done by a human being has these elements. Before one acts, there is some impetus, which is called inspiration. Any solution arrived at before work is actualized is a subtle form of work. Then work takes the form of action. First, one has to undergo the psychological process of thinking, feeling, and willing. And that is called impetus, or chodana. The inspiration to work is the same if it comes from the shastra or the guru. When the inspiration is there and the worker is there, then actual activity takes place by the help of the senses, including the mind, which is the center of all the senses. The sum total of all the constituents of an activity are called the accumulation of work, or sangraha. Okay? So Prabhupada uses this word accumulation also to describe this word sangraha before he says constituents of work. So now, are you thoroughly confused? Yes? Okay, now we'll have some questions just to, you know, cement the confusion further. Okay. No.
Only by done by the body and...
Yeah, it's the more gross things. There's another way to look at this verse, but first let's get this ready. Okay, go ahead. Okay, let's concentrate on this first, and then we'll go back to you. Yeah.
Is it also universal word?
I think this is universal. Because they're just speaking in very broad terms. Although, of course, it can apply to the devotees also, and to jnanis. Mainly, we're talking about jnanis here, who are performing nishkam karma yoga to purify their heart. And they may be at a very high level of that, ready to renounce the work. Right? That's why, see, that's the actual context which Vishnu Chakravarti Thakura gives. Now we know we're in the jnana section, right? And it is, you know, Prabhupada also said this is Vedanta. So this is actually pitched towards the persons who are renunciates, who are performing nishkam karma and the like, ready to renounce their work. They're actually jnanis. So they're analyzing work. Because normal people can't analyze. To them, this verse is just, you know, they can't figure out heads or tails what this means. This is for someone who's very intelligent, who's ready to actually give up work, and he understands everything about work and reactions to work and attachment to the fruits and like this. So that's the context of this. But it can apply to devotees. It can apply to karmis also, to non-devotees, common people. Because Prabhupada brings it to that level. He says thinking, feeling, and willing. And everybody does that before they work. You don't do something unless you think about it first. Like you think, oh, I'd like to watch this show on the TV, and then you get up and you turn on the TV. Right? You don't just suddenly go to the TV and just without any thought. Everything you do has to have some psychological foreground to preempt the action. Yeah, the constituents. That's called chodana. That's a preliminary stage. Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes and Prabhupada describes. First that comes. That's thinking, feeling, and willing.
But that is inspiration.
Yeah, inspiration.
And then you get a solution, how I'm going to work.
Then you decide what to do, then you do it. Then you use your senses, right? And then you do the actual work, and you're the one who's doing it. You're the karta. So the karta, karma, and with your karana is the instruments. Karana means instruments. So the soul has his instruments, which is the senses of the body, then he does the work. That's the constituents. That's the basis, substratum, the accumulation, the constituents.
The final work, what you have done.
What, the karma?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
And the senses. And
with your hand, you turn on the television. And you're the one who does it. So that's three things. There's always a subject, an object, and then the work. There's the subject, the object, and then there's the instrument. In any sentence, you also have subject, object, and then some instrument also. Subject is the karta, the object is the karma, and instrument is the senses. I think so, yeah.
Okay, but I don't know how to achieve it.
Right. If you don't have the knowledge, then you're not going to do it. You'll think about it first until you get the knowledge, or you'll search for knowledge how to do it before you do it. Like some people want to go to America, so that's their goal, their object. But then they have to know how to do it. So they're not going to get there until they have the knowledge. Then they ask their friends, they call the embassy, and they get some, papers, they speak to people at the U.S. Embassy, they get the knowledge, then they, now I understand what to do. Yes. Well, this is my idea. That in anything that we do, there's always sambandha, abhideya, and prayojan. So prayojan is the gyaya, and the sambandha is the knowledge, sambandha jnana. And then the karma is the abhideya, the action. You have jnana, sambandha, gyayam is the object, the prayojan, and the karma is the abhideya, the actual work, when you're doing it. So two of them are from the chodana, the subtle, preliminary thing, and then the third one, which is the abhideya, is from the more practical constituents of work, of the sangraha. Which makes sense. Well, the place means the body, right? Adhishtanam. That's defined as the body, right? So that's the body is what the worker is inside. So you could, because the atma can mean the body, the mind, or the soul. So the karta includes his body. Or you can say the body is also the karana. He's using the body as an instrument. If a certain person's very spiritual and he sees that I'm different from the body, then he's using the body as an instrument to do the work. He's real kshatragya. But if he's a dull materialist, then we can put the body back into the category of the karta. Ram nitai kijai. We get to that a little bit later, actually. That's another kind of karta. A kind of karta who's just told what to do. Did we already describe that? That's later on in this chapter, I think. Yeah, but anyway, then his impetus is the order from guru or shastra, which is also chodana, according to the Prabhupada and other acharyas. Anything else? Yes? 1814 and 1818. Right. You don't have to combine them together. We nobody's. Yes. Here in 18 we have 6 items. And in 14 we have 5 items. Some items are similar. Yes. Yes. So you want to stick 5 into 6 or 6 into 5? How you want to do it? Okay, I will try. But we have to start. We have to have some approach. So let's use 5 because 14 came first. So we use that as our basis. Okay. Please forgive me because I haven't done this before. So, but to please you, I'll try to do this. Okay. So. Adhishtanam means the body. We just did this with Ramnitai Prabhu. Okay? So the body can be either karta or karana, depending on the level of the person's consciousness. Alright? Karta is the same. Karta is the parigyata, and karta is the karta. So the parigyata from the first, from the chodana, karma chodana, he's also the knower, so he must be the doer. He's, right? First you know, think, feel, and will, and then you do. So parigata and karta are basically the same, but it's just from a different function, a different angle. Yeah, they're the same. But parigata is the karta before he does the work while he's thinking. Okay? So basically they're the same. So that is the karta, that's the same, right? Karanam, that's the same, the senses. So 3 of them we got out of the way, that's very clear. Then you have cheshta, which was described as the pranas. So that's the endeavor of the karta. Right? When the parigata finally decides to get moving, do something, then he becomes the karta. So then he's using his senses, karana. But the soul and the body are different. So what connects them? That's the pranas. So the mind's dhriti, his determination to do something, creates the pranas change. And it gives the body and the senses some shakti to do the work. Otherwise, if there's no conviction, the person just... He doesn't have enough shakti to do the work. So that is the cheshta. It's like in between the soul and the body. Between the soul and the senses. Cheshta is not the work done, the karma. No, it's the endeavor. It's defined by Vishnu Chakravarti as the pranas. The functioning of the life airs in the body. Which is no the willpower, the willing, thinking, feeling, willing, then that willing creates dhriti, right? And that dhriti changes the pranas, and then the pranas activate the senses. So it's kind of like in between the chodana and the sangraha. In between the impetus and the constituents or accumulation of work is this cheshta. It kind of links them together. And then the last thing is daiva, which is, well, you could say maybe left out from text 18. But then again, we know that the parigyata is the soul's, super soul's also along with the soul. But he's not doing the thinking, feeling, and willing. He's the upadrashta numantaja, he's the overseer and permitter. It seems that verse 18 is more or less focusing on the soul, the atma in the body. But verse 14 is a little bit broader. It's talking about the Lord, the Paramatma. That's the main focus on 14, that he is the super cause of everything. And when you get down to this practical world, this, you know, lokik vichar, then 18 is more detailed. Or you can say a nishkam karma yogi who's coming to the Gyan Nishta platform. You mean in devotee sense, context. In his bhajan, then he has to accept that which is connecting him with Krishna. Right? Isn't it? It depends on the level of the devotee. We're talking about someone who's at bhava bhakti. Then that which is pleasing to him is to love Krishna in Madhurya Ras. So he's entering into that lila. And that's what's pleasing to him. He sits and does nirjan bhajan, maybe, something like this. And, you know, like a new bhakta who's a Kanishta Adhikari, he has to more focus on, you know, accepting that which is not pleasing so that he can come to goodness and come to Nishta Bhakti. So therefore, Prabhupada said, work now, samadhi later. You know. So it depends on what level you're talking, the devotees at. You know, I mean, obviously the advanced devotee, he's not thinking about what is pleasing to me personally, to my senses, or what's not pleasing. Like Prabhupada, he didn't consider whether, he didn't think, oh yeah, I'd like to go to America to have a nice vacation to see the United States before I die. You know, he wasn't thinking like that. He was thinking, my Guru Maharaj told me to preach in the Western countries, so I should go and do it. Right? So that was his karma chodana, or his impetus to do it, because he wanted to please Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. It wasn't that he wanted to take a vacation and see America before he died, like some old Indian men might have this idea. I know. So in any case, the advanced devotees also, he doesn't think about what's pleasing to my senses, what not pleasing. He's thinking what's pleasing to Krishna and to Guru. Then he does that. He feels inspiration, thinking that his Guru will be pleased and Krishna will be pleased if I do this. Then that gives him great inspiration. Then he does the work. Okay, well, we discussed this at least two times before, right? The same topic. And I said that in the beginning, it's actually good if the person feels pleasure from the activity, because at least he's engaging in Krishna conscious activities, and we may encourage him to do that which he's attracted to doing. And then later, he'll become more focused on pleasing the object of his devotion, the person, the person, the object of his devotion, his Ishtadev or his guru, like that. But in the beginning, he can be encouraged to do that which he likes to do. It's kind of like dovetailing, you know. He didn't say anything about what level He just said this particular person is not attached to thinking in these terms. Because he's, well, he said he's, his activities are sattvic. So he's getting sattva-gun gyan from his sattvic actions. That's what allows him to be renounced. So this is like connected with the previous section. And the person in goodness, is not, he's not a ragi worker, right, or lubdhi. He's doing everything out of duty. So in Gyanamorg, the person's doing karma yoga, right, then this is an important feature. There's no ruchi in Gyanamorg. When a devotee gets ruchi, then he feels attracted to certain pastimes of Krishna, certain kinds of angas of bhakti over other angas of bhakti. Because then his ruchi kicks in, and then that becomes his impetus. And it's bringing him to Krishna, so then it's good. But these people, these gyanis, they don't have that. So it's just all detachment. So in Bhakti Marg, we follow Gyana Marg up to a point, right, for purification and knowledge and detachment. But then when we get ruchi, then we leave the gyanis behind. Then we let taste control us. or laying down. Laying down on the ground. You know, like the python man. And what is called fatalist, right, they call, right? Fatalist. Yeah, they're very popular in India also. Yeah, that's when they minimize the role of the jiva to nothing. That's a common misconception. So then you, so what is your question then? Mm-hmm. Right. 17. In the purport, okay. Well, they didn't stop the Americans. They're still going in the hellish direction. Yeah, right. Actually, I considered this thing when I was reading this, and somehow the last couple of days when I was sitting around in my room. I didn't really think of it too much, but it did come into my mind for a moment. That, you know, they also think that, you know, that they've given up their will and they're performing God's will and that they're free. And I was thinking, maybe they're actually free from reaction because they completely give up, you know, they're just thinking about God and they're performing, but it's such an evil activity, right? It's such an ignorant activity. Yeah, it's kind of like detachment in the mode of ignorance. You know what I mean? Like a tamagun tyagi or something like this. But they don't, you know, they won't get full knowledge because obviously such kind of activity is not ordained by God. It may be, actually, in many ways, they have a lot of points that are true because they say that, you know, the Americans are the white devil. They're polluting the whole planet with sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That's true. And they don't let the, you know, Star TV come into Iran, Iraq, and all these other countries. And, you know, the women, they cover their face, and, you know, they're very strict in this. And it's true. You know, through the cinema, Hollywood consciousness is spreading all around the planet, people becoming very degraded. So in that sense, they're true. The way they react or their particular strategy, you know, their abhideya, we don't agree with, but there are some bandha we agree with. You know, and, you know, okay, so they're thinking about God and performing these ignorant activities. Yeah, it's questionable, you know, the person actually giving their life for God. It's just like Ladini, you know, Mataji. She gave her life for God. And so these people are doing the same thing. So, you know, I would say they get a mishram, you know, karma reaction for this because there's so much meditating on their Lord, Allah, and at the same time they're performing such a sinful activity. So yes, it's very interesting actually, this idea. Right. Okay, now we get to the context. So now we're talking about here, the Supreme Lord is directly telling Arjuna to fight. Okay, that's the first difference. Those people, God's not directly, Allah's not coming to them directly. At least we will accept this, right? Maybe he is, but for the sake of discussion, we'll say, okay, we don't accept it. Allah is directly telling them. Because they're not such great saints, they're just common people, you know. And the second thing is that this was a very special thing, which you're talking about the rule of the whole world. Who's going to be the emperor? And you had a partial avatar of Kali, Duryodhana, right? And you have five, you know, Nitya Siddha Parikars of the Lord, of Vasudeva Krishna, the Pandavas there. And Krishna is establishing the righteousness for the whole world and also glorifying his pure devotees, the Pandavas. And we see that also that these, you know, the evil side, Duryodhana and his clan, they did everything to put themselves in the Atitayana category. Right, they tried to kill them with flames, with weapons, with poison. They tried to steal their land and wealth and their wife, all five. They deserve to be killed, you know, without a doubt. Okay, maybe the Americans have done some of these, but not all of them, right? They didn't try to, at least before this thing started, they didn't try to kill them. And they may have stolen some money from them. But that's about all, maybe. You know, through the political means, maybe America sucked oil out of the Middle East or something like this. So they, you have a completely different situation. Therefore, you know, the Americans are not Atitayana to the same degree that the Kauravas were. Maybe slightly they stole some money. So, therefore, we can't give credence to their abhideya, to their strategy to do this. If they want to not have Star TV and they don't want to import, you know, Playboy magazine, okay, fine, that's great. We will applaud them. But, you know, to kill innocent workers in an office and some old black ladies cleaning the floor, what is that? What, you know? What is? How is Allah going to be pleased? Maybe some of those ladies were Muslims, cleaning the floor. Oh, you know, salam alaikum. The whole building, just, you know. Yeah, the whole world.
Yeah.
That's true. That's true. But we see that they're not thinking still; they're just angry. I mean, we're thinking, they're thinking, but the Americans, are, most of them, are not thinking about what is the, you know, what is the deeper significance of this. They just hate the, you know, the Muslims. What happened after that? There was any guy that was wearing a turban and had a beard. A guy was a Sikh. He was, you know, pumping gas in a gas station in Texas, and the guy was killed the next day just because he looked kind of like from the East. You know what I mean? That's the Americans. They can't discriminate between... The guy was actually Indian. He wasn't from Middle East. He was just a Sikh. And he was killed. And, you know, the next day. Because he represented all of the evil, you know, people from the East. You know what I mean? So anyway, it doesn't seem like any of the Americans are thinking that this has any kind of deep significance other than the fact that there are some crazy people in the Middle East who don't like us and who are Muslims and they're terrorists and we should kill them. That's all they think, basically. Yeah, they probably will get some kind of... They probably will get something added to all of their bad karma. There's some mix.
Krishna
Yeah, that's their karma chodana. You know, their jihad, and they're going to go to Mecca, the Nitya Mecca, something. It's hard to say what they're thinking exactly, but there's some credence there for this idea in their action. There's some validity is there. I mean, it's in the mode of ignorance, but there's still something. Well, yeah, they're not doing these things in the sense of like from a higher order or higher authority. But their doership is not developed enough that they can take responsibility for it. Yeah, sure, there's some doership, but it's not like developed enough where they can feel that I'm doing this action and I'm responsible for the results of this action. They don't think like that. They're just kind of madly doing something without some feeling of responsibility. Because they're not, it's connected with intelligence, obviously. They're not intelligent enough to understand the ramifications of what they're doing. So I think that doership has to be also defined, which it's not really, it's just this term. But it would seem that person, to be a doer, then he has to understand the ramifications of what he's doing. Because sometimes you come into a court of law and the person breaks the law and you tell the judge, I didn't know that this was wrong. Then the judge say, okay, we'll let you go this time, but if you do it again, you're going to go into jail for a long time. Now get out of here. Right? They do like this sometimes. Or other times they say, you know, ignorance of the law is no excuse, you have to go to jail. But sometimes judges, depending on the circumstance, of course, you know, he may say, okay, you didn't know. Maybe you're from another country or something like that. You know, okay, now you can go. But don't do it again. Otherwise, if I catch you again, you're finished. I'll lock you up. So, there is some, you know, knowledge or intelligence is definitely connected with this idea. So someone who's a doer, then he has to know the ramifications. He's responsible for his action. If someone doesn't know the ramifications, he doesn't have enough knowledge, his intelligence not developed enough, he's crazy, an animal or a child, then you can't say there's full sense of doership in that person. And that's why they're not, in any court of law, in any country, generally they just let those persons go. Children are not kept accountable, animals. Crazy people. Huh? It depends on the circumstance, you know. If he's like just, you know, if a crazy person, you know, his caretaker leaves a gun in the room and he's just looking at it and suddenly, you know, the thing goes off. The bullet goes out the window and kills the neighbor. You know, what do you think God will do? Is the person going to be, you know, sent to Yamaloka for sentence for that? No. This foolish guy doesn't know what he's doing. He's got a gun. Just accidentally went off and killed somebody. No, you know, there's different circumstances. That's my point. You have other circumstances. The person's more conscious, then he'll get a reaction. Yamaraj will come and say, you did this. And I said, yeah, but I didn't know. Yes, you knew enough. Come with me. You know, like this. So it depends on the circumstance. We can't just give some, you know, blanket law. Just like in the Mahabharata, there's this whole thing where they're testing Duryodhana. Dhritarashtra is testing Duryodhana and Yudhisthira. So then they have some guy who comes in who did some crime. And then yes, Duryodhana, what should we do with him? Says like this. And Yudhisthira, what should we do? Okay, now some brahmana comes. He did some similar crime. So what, Duryodhana, what should we do? Okay, Yudhisthira, what should we do? So Yudhisthira gets very strict on the Brahman, and the Shudra just tell him, don't do this again, get out. Because the Brahman's higher level of consciousness, he's more responsible. Right? So he got a much stricter sentence. Duryodhana didn't do the same thing. So then Dhritarashtra understood, yes, Yudhisthira is superior in his ability to rule. Like this. Right? You've heard of this? In Mahabharata, you've read this? It's important. Things are to be judged according to time, place, circumstance, context, and consciousness, and varna and ashram. Everything has to be all considered. Leader means responsibility. Prabhupada mentioned this also about GBC. He said, be careful with your GBC, you're very responsible. He's more accountable for his actions. His consciousness is higher. But still, like, okay, he's so responsible. But he say he's acting, you know, for Krishna, and then something bad happens, then, okay, he'll take responsibility, but actually he's not responsible. I'll give you a good example. There was a Guru Prasad Swami, in GBC of South America, and some on one of the farms in his area, some cows were stolen and then brought to the slaughterhouse and sold, something like that. Some crazy devotee did this. You know. And so then it was found out by the cow protection, you know, ministry or whatever, and then came to you know, the GBC. So he submitted his resignation as a GBC because he felt responsible because he was, you know, the GBC of that area. And then they said, no, it's okay, you couldn't have been fully accountable for this. But he felt himself responsible. But the body, they said, it's okay. They could see that actually probably his responsible action and presenting his resignation might have had some even further effect to convince the GBC men that he was innocent. Because that is, you know, the behavior of someone who is on that level, who is a guru, sannyasi, and a GBC. Should be like that. But then it's not that we should, you know, it's not that the GBC should say, yeah, you know, kick him out, you know, like this. Right? They should respond in a different way. But subjectively, he did the right thing for his idea that he felt responsible. Objectively, maybe he wasn't so responsible for it. Because they can't control every single thing that's going on in this, all these countries, that just one man. Right? You see? So when you're speaking philosophy, you always have to discriminate between subjective and objective things. Especially in Guru Tattva, and here we're talking about, you know, a weird situation, you know, these Muslim terrorists, or you're talking about, you know, GBC in this circumstance. You're talking about subjective, well, how he is supposed to feel. How is he supposed to see it? And then the objective view of the society or the Lord. So you, especially when you're talking about guru and disciple, then you have to, if you don't define subject and object, then you're going to get all confused. Because, you know, then you get, like in the Shastra says, Guru is Shakshat Hari. So then someone becomes a guru and he thinks, yes, I'm Shakshat Hari. That's really crazy. You know? Right? No, the disciple sees him as Shakshat Hari. And not that everybody on the street is supposed to see him as Shakshat Hari. Or even the other devotees in the community. Just the disciple, he sees him. Like, because somehow or other, that person's inspiring, you know, that person to come to God. Somehow that disciple feels God's presence in that devotee. But other people may not feel it. So subjectively, it's subjective idea is very important. And then the guru, he has to think that I'm just a menial peon and you know, and I'm a servant of my guru. He never thinks that I am a guru. Right? And then, you know, you can get to very subtle ramifications of all of this kind of thing. So you always have to discriminate. Now, I've never heard anyone preach this before, but the more I get into the philosophy and the application of the philosophy, the more I see subjective and objective views have to be understood. Otherwise, you can never actually get the real full Tattva Siddhanta. You'll always be confused about what to do and what not to do, how to apply and how not to apply. Yeah, you can bring it to that level, sure. Yeah, because you still, although you're suffering and you accept that, but you still want to use your body to serve the Lord. And you know that the body is valuable in doing your bhajan, in developing Krishna consciousness. So therefore you do that to continue to use the body that was given to you. It's an instrument given to you, so you're meant to keep it healthy. You made a mistake in the past, but that doesn't mean you should continue that mistake now or in the future. So you accept the fact that the body's suffering due to some foolish thing you did in the past, but not to continue the foolishness. It's maybe on the border of using this kind of paradigm. Subjective and objective may not be so much applicable or in this kind of example. But objective means kind of more level-headed, and subjective means your mood in any circumstance, your vision. So, but a more advanced devotee, instead of dividing subjective and objective, will say, this body was given to me by God. I made a mistake in the past. Now let me try to correct it. Now I accept the suffering, and I also accept the suffering that I have to take this medicine, which also may be another kind of suffering. You know, but my duty is to keep the body healthy for serving Krishna. Therefore I do this. Something like this.
Godlessness or lack of Krishna.
Yeah, a pretty strong statement, huh?
So, I think
the word responsible has different meanings, actually. Well, not different applications. Responsible meaning here, I'm the doer, you know, kevalam karta. And that there's no other factor, right? And the other common use of the word responsibility is someone who is efficient, careful. Right? Like this. Yeah, right. This is like the negative sense of it. It's connected. Here, responsibility means negatively that I'm the only doer. There's no other cause. I'm doing this alone by my own strength. I don't need God. I'm responsible. I can do it. This is the kind of asuric, rajasic connotation of the word responsible. That's how it's being used here. Responsible has a positive and negative connotation. The positive one is more of goodness. Like in Ukraine, there was an air show. And the jet fighters were doing all these far-out things. And one of them, you know, came down and crashed and then, just went right into the crowd of people and just mauled, just like a lawnmower. Just, you know, arms and legs went flying everywhere. And there was hundreds of people killed, children, and, you know, it was like a massacre. So the guy, the head of the Air Force, he handed in his resignation. That was the right thing for him to do. So he felt responsible. But the responsible in the kind of rajasic or asuric level means that, you know, I can do this alone. I don't need God, and I alone will be the cause of the result of the activity. So Krishna said that you don't think that you're the cause of your activity. Right? Karmanyeva dikaraste, mahaphalesha gadacha. The karma phala hetu bo. You're not. Don't think that you're the hetu of the karma phala. Because you're not. Not ultimately. I mean, you should try your best, but what can you do? You should be responsible in the sattvic sense, but not in the rajasic sense. These kind of details are not described here. That's why I say, I mean, that's why I read this, because it's interesting. You could take it the wrong way, obviously, this sentence. Right? Responsibility arises from godlessness. Yes, so let's just, you know, become, you know, fatalists. Leave everything up to God. Just surrender completely to the will of God. Yes. Then they try to wake you up in the morning and say, no, it's all the will of God. I'm going, go back to sleep. You know, you can completely, you know, misconstrue everything from that point. Everything can go to hell. That's all right. My wife and children, anyway, let the Lord take care of them. He's the doer. I'm not. Right? You should see the Lord, but then you should think, well, what's my role to play? The Christian Catholic monk or bishop, he said that we should act as if everything depends on us, but we should pray as if everything depends on him. So a person acts responsibly, but ultimately he knows that everything's been controlled by God. Because he knows that I am only one of the five factors. And the most important and ultimate cause is the super soul. He's the super cause behind everything. So anyway, the devotee tries to always see what the Lord wants. And then the more advanced he is, then the more he tries to do that. But it may be that the Lord wants different things of him. So he has to decide, well, what is the priority now? I mean, you can, you know, you get to a fine line. You get to a fine line. And then you get down to someone's personal life. Just like Ladini Mataji, she was invited by Bhakti Tirtha Swami to go to Africa. But she didn't have to go. Right? It was just a kind of casual invitation. Why don't you come to Africa and preach for a while? Yeah, okay. And then he left, and she took it very seriously, you know. And someone else might have not taken it, or maybe if she was still taking care of the Jagannath deities in New Vrindavan, she would have thought, well, it would be nice, but I have my responsibility. Obviously, I can't just give this up. You know what I mean? It's like, but if the Lord, the next day, it was arranged that, you know, someone else became the head pujari, and then, you know, someone gave you an airplane ticket to go to Ghana, you know, it becomes more clear, oh, God wants me to go to Africa and preach, you know. But until that time, it may not, you know, a devotee may not think that it's, that's, you know, not so important. Or maybe it's just a coincidence or something like this. Just like, you know, during this thing with Tamal Krishna Maharaj, when he was taking brahmacharis from the temples in America on the Radha Damodar party, and all the presidents were up in arms, and there was a whole thing in Mayapur, there was all this kind of political confrontation, and then they came to Prabhupada, and Prabhupada said this famous thing, you know, resolution, no solution, revolution, revolution, resolution, no solution. And then, you know, so anyway, finally he decided, you know, that, yeah, it's great, let the grihasthas, they can be the presidents, and you have to, you know, do something else like that. And then Tamal Krishnamurti said something like, well, I mean, what am I supposed to do? They can send me to the moon or send me to China or somewhere. Right? And then the next day, Prabhupada called him in right after Mangal Arati. And he understood, uh-oh, I said the wrong thing. Because Trivikram Maharaj was the one, he came to him in Mangal Arati and said, Prabhupada wants to see you. And he said, oh no. Then he said, I'm not going. Immediately he told like this, you know, to write that to Trivikram's song. So anyway, he said, he went to see Prabhupada. Prabhupada was, you know, coming out of the bath, he's put on his tila. He said, so yesterday you said that you mentioned about going to China. And he said, I was just joking. I mean, like, you know, going to the moon or something. He says, you might have been joking, but the Lord has spoken through you. And he said, but what about my Radha-Damodar party? What about all this work I have to be doing? And he said, I'm not going to go. And Prabhupada's hands started shaking. He became very angry. He said, you must go. I take everything away from you. And you just sit in Mayapur and chant Hare Krishna, or you go to China. You have two choices. Then he said, oh. And I think it was Guru Kripa was in the back. He said, I'll go. And he said, no, I want him to go. You know what I mean? It's like Prabhupada took this little thing, and, you know, and he saw it as Krishna. Right? Tamal Krishnamurti was just joking. He wasn't there. He didn't have any idea of going to China. For him, it was like going to the moon. But Prabhupada took this, you know, that this is Krishna speaking through. So it depends on our level, you know, how we see Lord and what we're responsible for. Yes, that's correct. So according to your analysis, then these terrorists are still accountable, even though they seem to think that they're doing it for God. Because God doesn't say in the Quran anywhere that you should go and, you know, explode, you know, some buildings, you know, or in the trains or the undergrounds, you know, when the demons, you know, become sinful, then you should go and explode yourself and kill everybody, along with innocent people. I don't think you're going to find any statements in the Quran like this. I don't think Allah would come directly and say, yes, this is good, go and kill them. It's crazy. It's just they're fakirs, and their leaders are fanatics. They're terrorists. So but they hold the authority. So those people under them are also, you know, going to hell along with those terrorists. But those leaders, they're going to go to the darkest region of ignorance, because they have more responsibility than those just individuals who are being sent. I would say that this is the philosophy applied in this case, that those individuals are somewhat innocent in being directed by their leaders, and the leaders get the brunt of that karma, and they get some, they're relieved somewhat because of their lessened sense of doership. Yeah, instigator of murder. Yeah. They undermine the whole Vedic civilization. Right. I don't think God likes that very much. They're using his name to free themselves for some foolish act in all cases. Okay, I think we've come to the end of our rope in this discussion. It's already 8 o'clock, well, 5 to 8. Let's have our last comment. And that's true. Because they're riding on their piety. they're sent to a place where there's no karma to enjoy. But later they come back and then they are responsible. I think it's like a vacation for them where there's no accountability or there's no immorality amongst the devas. Was it Urvashi told to Arjuna this philosophy? Because Arjuna said, "I see, you're like my, you know, great, great, great grandmother. How can I?" And she said, "Come on, there's no immorality here. This is Svarga. Everybody can just enjoy as they like." He said, "Yes, but I'm from the mortal world. I cannot help my feelings." Yeah, that's true. Anyway, that would have to be kind of reconciled along with his paradigm. But in general, I would say that's correct. No, but that was a curse from Narada. That's not karma. That's directly from the Bhakti Shakti avatar Narada Muni. That's from Aparad, then he cursed them. Which was a blessing too. It has nothing to do with karma at all. That's Aparad, Guru Aparad. That's not karma. That's in a different field. Aparad and karma are different. Yeah, but there you can't say animals because they're so cultured. They're mainly in goodness with some passion, and animals are mainly in ignorance. But they're allowed to, they can have sex with different women, they don't have to get married, and, you know, there's just society girls there. It's like a, you know, it's kind of like a vacation place where there's just prostitutes, and then you can just enjoy. And they're very beautiful, and that's what Swarga is all about. It's fulfilling your desires in a very sophisticated, cultured way. Huh? They're not what? They have children at the very end of their life, right before they pass away. No, they don't have children until the very end of their life. I can't answer all these questions. The sutras are there, and there may be some exceptions. I don't know all this, you know, Hindu folklore that you know. I'm a philosopher. These are all from curses, though, right? There's no karma, though. That's just aparad. I think this is the generalized, because I've read it in different places, and it seems very logical, and they don't have karma. Not only in London, in the whole Western countries, everywhere. Yeah, but that's the culture. That's the whole purpose of going there. So they're not there to perform vidhis and dharmas and, you know, maryada. They're just enjoying it. They did that already here on the earth. And now they're free. Now they can just enjoy without incurring any sin. That's the purpose of Swarga. Then they come down again and they act piously and then they go back there and enjoy again. It's like, you know, it's like the paycheck or the vacation. It's like the reward. Some more, you know, unlimited free sense enjoyment without any ramifications. Legal sense enjoyment. So the laws and the social customs are different there than they are here. That's different from morality. I mean, morality in the sense of conventional morality, vidhis, you know, varnashram regulations, these things. Aparad is also always there. Can always happen. Cursing and such things. Who's praying to Brahma? The sons of Marichi. So that because of their offense, then they took birth. as the sons of Kalanimi. Thank you. Yeah, Kalanimi. And Hiranyakashipu first. Right? Actually, in the commentaries, they took birth as the sons of Hiranyakashipu first, and then the sons of Kalanimi. Then Devaki. Yeah. So they went through a whole thing. But anyway, it's also Leela. They appear in Devaki's womb, and then Krishna brings them back at the end of his Leela. I don't know. If I was ever there, which I doubt, I would have long forgotten. You think about it, you try to apply it. I'm just telling you some sutras, and what can I can't explain every circumstance. Especially, you know all these things more than I do. Huh? Okay, we'll stop now. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.